Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the second week of October, and this week, President Biden announced the Port of Los Angeles will operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in an effort to reduce the backlog of ships that are waiting to unload and ameliorate the supply chain problems that are causing trouble throughout the economy. Of course, the president does not run the Port of Los Angeles, and this isn't the sort of thing he'd usually involve himself with directly. But as we talked about on last week's show, when the problems are spread throughout the economy, the president may need to show that he's going wherever they are. It's just one part of seeking to address this autumn of discontent, as spending packages full of progressive priorities remain stalled in Congress, and inflation continues to be elevated for longer than forecasters expected, with the job market slowing down. So how is President Biden doing with that? To talk about that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined on the right by Sean Trendy, senior elections analyst at Real Clear Politics and fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And on the left, Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Josh.
Our special guest this week is Amy Walter. Amy is publisher and editor-in-chief of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Josh.
So, Amy, I wanted to bring you on to talk about a column that you wrote earlier this month about what's eating voters. You've been observing a number of focus groups. Can you tell us about what you're seeing about what people might be more dissatisfied with than they were a few months ago?
What I've been noticing, and I've been sitting in on focus groups that sort of span the spectrum from swing voters, those include people maybe who voted for Donald Trump in 2016, but voted for Biden in 2020, or maybe they sat out in 2016, voted third party, voted for Biden this time around, and those who are so-called surge voters, voters who hadn't turned out to vote in 2016, maybe haven't voted in a long time, or maybe 2018, 2020 was the first time they ever voted. They voted overwhelmingly for Democrats. And what you hear in every one of these groups is a sense of deep frustration, disappointment, and this idea that keeps coming up, at least the way I interpreted it, was just a frustration that they thought their lives, once Donald Trump was out of office, would look different. We wouldn't have the constant polarization, divisions, the fighting over Facebook that has been sort of a part of our lives now for the last 5 years. I can't talk to so-and-so anymore about Trump because it's destroying our friendship. That COVID, we'd be beyond that. That the economy would be kind of up and running. They're desperate to get back to normal, and nothing has felt normal.
And do you have a sense, is there a clear through line on what they think should be done differently to fix that? Are there things that they specifically want the government to do that it's not doing?
Yeah, so some of it, Josh, I think, everybody came into this election, this last election in 2020, with different ideas of what returning to normal meant, right? And as I said, for some people, it literally was just, I want my kids to go to school. I want to be able to leave my house, go back to my normal job, and not have COVID plaguing our lives. For others, it was, I want a pre-Trump world where we aren't literally just in these existential battles every day over what America is or is not. And I want a president who's, not stoking that division. And then others really did think we're going to go back to normal, meaning a pre-Trumpian world, or what Trump helped to reveal, which is deep structural inequalities, especially racial inequalities. Trump pumped those up. The Democrat is going to come in and really address those, really address also some of the inequalities that COVID revealed. We've always known are there, but newly revealed. And instead, all of those things feel like they're still here, if not worse. And so I think what they would like to see is different, but I think underlying all of it is that none of them believe that Joe Biden is doing much to change any of it, right? That he's just not even really a factor in their lives, and making those changes back to whatever their normal was that they wanted to see. And so he's, in many ways, you know, voters kept saying, I'm sure we talked about this during 2020, I can't wait till we have a president who I don't have to think about anymore, right? I don't have to see his tweets. I don't have to fight with my family about it. It's going to be done. Can just go to sleep at night, wake up the next morning, not even know who the president is. But I think a lot of people are realizing, actually, I do want to know what the president's doing. I don't want to have him tweeting every 10 minutes. But boy, I sure would like him to have a firmer handle on the steering wheel.
Liz, it's interesting. The president, I think, has been trying to shift at least his public appearance on that. This announcement about the Port of Los Angeles, the president involving himself in that in a way that you wouldn't usually expect. And so it seems to be a response to that criticism that he might not seem engaged in these issues. But the flip side of that is that when you talk about this stuff, then you start to own it even when it's stuff that you don't really fully control. And I think that's a hazard, specifically with supply chain issues and with a lot of the things that are causing trouble, both economically and with the virus in the country right now. My understanding specifically about the port is that, you know, the port is just one cog in this machine. If you don't have enough truckers ready to go pick up stuff at the port, it doesn't matter that much if the port has more hours that it's operating. So I'm wondering about, you know, the president can go out there and show I'm working on this. The problem is that some of this stuff is truly outside of his control. And I don't know about the, you know, if he engages in the stuff and these things continue to be issues, I don't know how much that's going to get voters to give him more of the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, but I think this is a longstanding challenge that every president deals with, which is when the American people are frustrated, when they're upset, when there's some level of panic spreading. And I do think at this point you're starting to see a kind of low-level panic spreading because people are noticing regional shortages in certain products. Once people start worrying about things like that, especially in the context of the holidays, which is where I think people are now, then the executive, you know, has to either address it head on, assure people that it's being worked on in some kind of way, even if there's not a huge amount the president can do about it, or say there's really nothing I can do about it. In that case, I think you risk people feeling even more panicked and then possibly starting to behave in some less than ideal ways in response to those feelings. I think the closest analogy is maybe gas prices. You know, we've had several bouts of gas prices spiking and presidents in office vowing to do something about it, even when in many cases there's basically nothing that they could do about it.
Sean, I'm looking at how Republicans message this issue, and one of the clear messages is that there are restrictions that Democrats, especially local and state office holders, have put in place that are unnecessary, and they would do less of that. That's especially around schools. And so that addresses the concerns of one set of voters whose concern is maybe that the government is imposing too many restrictions in response to COVID. What I don't really see is a clear Republican message about how under their rule, these underlying problems would be better, a message that they would have the COVID outbreak itself under better control, a clear message about why the economy would function better in certain places like this. Am I missing something? What's the Republican message about how they would manage these issues better?
You know, I think one of the lessons that Republicans and parties in general have learned over the past few midterms, maybe even going back to 2006, is that you actually can sort of beat something with nothing. That, you know, in 2006, Democrats were urged to kind of, you know, they didn't have a particularly unified message on things. They didn't like the Iraq War. Some people wanted a hard timetable for withdrawal. Other Democrats were a little more like, I just don't like how Bush is doing it. It's not the days, I think, of the contract with America or whatever, where a party takes a strong positive stand are over because we're so polarized now. And I think a big picture thing we're learning is that Trump is ultimately, to our horror, Trump is a symptom of our polarization and not the disease itself. But because we're so polarized, these elections ultimately become referenda on the party in power. Almost the lineup in Senate races and House races between the president's job approval in a state or district is almost one-to-one. now. And so if you can tear the president's job approval down, you're tearing down your opponent's percentage in the vote. So I think they're making a calculated decision that it's enough just to oppose him and point out the things that are going wrong. We'll figure out how to govern later.
Amy, how are people describing their concerns specifically about these economic issues? Are you hearing people say things are too expensive? Are you hearing people say things are not available? Because if we're trying to figure out what needs to change in the economy for public perceptions to turn around, I'm interested in what people are bothered by, especially because we're in this odd position where one of the drivers of the inflation that we've seen is very likely on the demand side, which is to say that household balance sheets are strong. The government made these really large payments out to people during the crisis that gave people more purchasing power. And that means that even as people face higher prices, that they also typically have higher spending power. Now that's unevenly distributed across households. But that, I assume, has a different effect on public opinion than if prices are higher simply because there is an energy shortage or something like that.
What we've seen over the last 20 or so years is sort of a decoupling between how voters feel about the economy and a sitting president. So Democrats much less willing to give a Republican president credit, much quicker to put blame on him about the economy, and Republicans do the same with Democrats. So that's part of the challenge here. To me, though, it gets back to this issue of normal and the idea of, you know, no matter where you go in this country, every single restaurant, it seems, or store has a sign up front that says, hey, we're really sorry, we don't have enough staff. Please don't get angry if your meal takes longer to get here, or we had to cut down our hours, so we're only open for dinner now. There is just this feeling that, boy, it's more than just stuff is backed up. It's like people feeling the sense that the economy is shifting in ways they don't really understand, and that while COVID was a big driver of all of this, that maybe these changes are going to be substantial. And finally, I feel this way too, the sense for those of us who are office worker types, like, we don't know when we're going back to our offices. I talk to everybody about that. When are you guys going back? What are your bosses telling you? Nobody really understands that. I just felt like, boy, by this time, that's what I hear a lot of. I thought by this time, you know, by the fall of 2021, we'd be kind of close to normal, and we're not.
Liz, what does this mean for trying to sell transformative change in what the government does? I mean, I sort of suspect that one of the problems politically with the big social and climate spending package that Democrats are trying to move through Congress, in addition to the thing is so sprawling that it's hard to explain to people what's in it. A lot of the programs are still sort of sketched on the back of a napkin. So even if you tell them there's a program for childcare or pre-K, it's not immediately obvious how that will affect them personally. But the other thing is, you know, I feel like a lot of people, they see some grand plan and they say, can we fix this stuff first, that get the economy back to work as it was supposed to be working, that the level of trust that people have in the government to do something new really well is probably lower at a time when it seems like even the things that we used to be able to do in the past are not working. So how do you message that if you're coming from the left and you want to be able to say both, you know, we're gonna fix this incidental stuff that's a real problem right now, and we're gonna focus on big changes for the long term?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what's happening right now in terms of supply chain, and I think the United States just not quite feeling like it usually does. And I think it's worth communicating this to the degree that we can, is global in nature, right? I mean, this has to do with the impact of a pandemic that affected the entire globe on the international shipping process. But I think it's worth trying to distinguish that from the things that are going on domestically long term. And so when you talk about, well, what's going on with workers? How come you can put a sign up in a window saying that you have jobs available and not get anybody, you know, applying? Well, working conditions kind of suck in a lot of cases, right? Or wages suck. And at that point, you can start talking about the programs that are in this thing that are available for workers, right? I mean, there's opportunity here for a really nice paid leave program that was part of Biden's own agenda when he ran. I think that's a really, really decent part of the whole Build Back Better American Families plan. I think that's something that people would be interested in if it were explained clearly to them. I think it's worth talking about the child tax credit, right? I mean, it's worth thinking about getting back on our feet and starting to, you know, get out there and live life as normal again. But, you know, I think it's also the case that living in a pandemic, it's like living in a war, right? I mean, things aren't going to be normal for a while. People are still dying. That's how it is. It's unfortunate.
Sean, what do you make of that?
At the end of the day, voters, especially swing voters, you know, such as they are today, don't pay a whole lot of attention to the ins and outs of policy. So I think there's kind of two takeaways from that. The first is Matt Iglesias wrote during the Obamacare debates, wrote a great article, short. It was only like a paragraph long, but it was called Majorities Are for Doing Stuff. And his basic argument on Obamacare was, you know, you shouldn't look so much to what public opinion is. You won this majority, and the reason you have this majority is so you can do stuff, so you should go do stuff. And I think our polarization and the fact that the swing voters that are left don't pay a lot of attention to the ins and outs and nuances of policy means that Democrats really should do what they want to do and what they think is best. Whether you do it or whether you don't do it, I don't think affects the outcome all that much. At the same time, I'm just skeptical. That voters are going to look at things and say, oh, you know, there's this benefit now, and I carefully weigh it in my decision on who to vote for. I mean, we see that. I mean, the child tax credit that appears in my bank account every, you know, 15th of the month, which I'm probably going to have to pay back at the end of the year, but that's another discussion altogether. That child tax credit is like a tangible thing that people are seeing right now, and yet it doesn't seem to be moving the needle that much for the Biden administration. And so I actually think the bigger things that Biden can do are what he's trying to do with this port authority thing, which is, you know, be more of a presence and be more engaged. You know, there were a lot of governors who did terrible things in terms of policy during COVID, and yet their job approvals remained robust because it looked like they cared. You know, and I think that has more of an impact on how swing, those types of valence issues have more of an impact on how swing voters evaluate a presidency than the nuances of public policy.
Let's take a quick break. I'll be back with Sean Trendy of Real Clear Politics and AEI, Liz Brunig of The Atlantic, and Amy Walter of The Cook Political Report to talk about redistricting and whether one reason to do what you can with your majority is that Democrats are very likely to lose that majority at next year's elections. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, columnist for Insider. On the right is Sean Trendy, senior elections analyst at Real Clear Politics and fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. And our special guest this week is Amy Walter. Amy is publisher and editor-in-chief of the Cook Political Report. Because we just had a census, it's time for House and state legislative districts to be redrawn. And as was the case 10 years ago, Republicans enter this process with an advantage. They control legislatures in more states, and some Democratic-leaning states have adopted procedures where Democrats don't actually get to draw their own lines. In California, for example, districts are drawn by an independent commission. Now, all of that said, this Republican advantage is maybe not as large as a lot of the partisan commentary and media commentary has made it out to be. And that's partly because the maps being redrawn were already quite favorable to Republicans. And it's partly because in states like Texas, most of the population growth is in Democratic-leaning areas. So as we come up on a major test of the two parties' strength under Joe Biden, Virginia is going to have a closely contested governor's race in a few weeks. Let's look at how the two parties stand coming up toward next year's midterm elections on these new maps. Amy, you at the Cook Political Report, you have a scorecard by state, and I guess your forecast is that redistricting might cost Democrats 1.5 seats on average across the whole country. Why is that effect so modest?
Great question. And you raised it in your intro a little bit, which is one, you know, for Republicans, even in states where they control the entire process, they did most of the really good gerrymandering in 2010. And so there's not much left to gerrymander. The other is, as you pointed out, the growth, especially in places like Texas or Georgia, has been in the suburbs, in and around big cities. And the only way to redistricting in those places really is to play defense. It's much more important to try to shore up some of your incumbents who are Republicans in those fast-growing suburbs by trying to move more rural areas into their districts. There's only so much of that you can do. So what you're left with then is a pretty good process for Republicans. They probably get a couple seats out of this, maybe more. But the other thing to really watch for is what happens in New York. And I think what Democrats are hoping, national Democrats are hoping, is that state Democrats are going to play hardball there, not agree to a commission-drawn map, and instead get a map drawn that is much less favorable to Republicans, which is putting it mildly. And this, to me, Josh, is the bigger story of redistricting. And Ali Mutnick over at Politico, who's been doing great work, wrote about this idea that I think a lot of good government groups had continue to have about gerrymandering, is that, look, if we just take line drawing out of the hands of partisan legislators, people whose literal political livelihood depends on what that line drawing looks like, we'll have fairer maps, we'll have a fairer system, we'll get rid of gerrymandering. But what we're finding, and I'm sitting in Virginia right now, is this brand new commission, surprise, surprise, is basically breaking down over partisan divisions among the people drawing the maps. They're not legislators, but they're still partisan. And we're seeing the same thing in Colorado, Michigan, where you can't undo partisanship just by taking out the legislators from the partisan, from the line drawing.
Sean, one thing that I think I see in this process, I'm interested if you share this view, is that it looks like Democrats are trying harder than Republicans during this round of redistricting, which is to say, as Amy notes, it's very likely that legislative Democrats in New York who have full control of the process for the first time in decades are going to basically blow up the commission system that is supposed to draw lines in New York, instead draw their own gerrymandered map that might allow them to pick up as many as 5 seats. We're likely to get an even more intricately ridiculous Maryland congressional district map. You should look up what that map looks like. It's completely insane. But that's likely to be drawn in a way such that Maryland will elect 8 Democrats and 0 Republicans to the House. On the flip side, I feel like I'm seeing Republicans pull certain punches. In Indiana, they could have tried to draw a map that would have eliminated the Democratic district that's in the northwest corner of that state. They didn't really try to do that. We're likely to see a Democrat reelected there. In Kentucky, it's likely that Republicans will not try to break up the one Democratic district in that state in Louisville. There is some Republican gerrymandering. We're likely to see Nashville broken up in several pieces so Republicans can pick up one more seat in Tennessee. But it sort of looks like Democrats are working harder at maxing out the opportunities they have in the places where they can control the map drawing. I'm interested in why that would be the case, why Republicans are not being more aggressive where they could be.
Yeah, I think I was actually thinking the exact same thing. Another example is Illinois, where there's a reasonable chance they're going to, you know, despite a pretty lopsided delegation, they're probably going to pick up 2 more seats and maybe eliminate 3 Republican seats. And yet you have Republicans, like you said, pulling their punches in states like Missouri, Kansas City. Those are 2 other ones where it's looking like they won't bacon-mander out the Kansas City districts in those 2 states.
Just for listeners, a bacon-mander is when you draw long, thin congressional districts basically to put a piece of a city in with lots of rural area. And depending on the ratios, you can do that to create Democratic districts that stick way out from the city or to create Republican districts that stick way into the city. The map in Illinois is going to be a Democratic bacon-mander like that. But Republicans in some of the states you mentioned, like Missouri, seem to be passing on the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, that's an excellent summary, better than I could have done. I'm not sure exactly what's going on here. You know, you look at the Maryland map and you would think that perhaps Republicans would take that as an inspiration. You know, maybe they're a little bit concerned about threats of litigation. You know, they have the experience of drawing a Maryland-like map in Pennsylvania and having it be overturned by the state Supreme Court. They also have concerns about racial gerrymandering lawsuits. When they draw maps with ridiculous lines, it's hard to separate race from partisanship in some states. So maybe they're a little bit concerned about that. That certainly prevents them from drawing, say, a 7-0 map in Alabama. They have to draw at least one and maybe two minority-majority districts there. But yeah, I do have the same general sense that you have, and maybe Amy or Liz have a better explanation than I've been able to come up with, that Republicans aren't producing these maximalist maps in places like Kentucky and Missouri and Indiana.
Yeah, Liz, what do you make of that? I mean, I think a common complaint that you hear, well, from partisans on both sides, but you also hear it in the Democratic Party, is that, you know, we don't play hardball like the other side does. This looks like sort of, you know, really, you know, pretty serious real politic by Democrats here, finding where they can marshal this power in a map that should provide them significant disadvantages, and they're closing at least a good portion of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for Republicans, I mean, Sean's probably right. I think they're also concerned just because it was such a hot summer in terms of Republicans making efforts, especially in southern states, to place restrictions on voting, right? So voter ID laws, et cetera, restricting early voting in Georgia and Mississippi. That brought about such widespread anger and led to so many weeks of protest, including, you know, quite serious protest from businesses. Major corporations signing big letters and making sort of threatening statements and threatening capital strike, to the point that Ted Cruz and some other typically quite business-friendly Republican senators were writing open letters and making public statements threatening these businesses. And I think that was pretty ugly for Republicans. I don't think they enjoyed that at all. And I think there is fear that when it comes to things the public might react to as, you know, threatening democracy, undermining democracy, setting up unfair votes, they could find themselves back in a similar situation. That just might not be something they want to do right before 2022.
Amy, when you look at these new voting laws that have come in Republican-controlled states, as you and your colleagues at Cook start handicapping races next year, how, if at all, do you see that stuff changing election outcomes? Does it matter in terms of who wins races, what sort of laws those states have enacted?
It's an essential question, and yet it's one that's really hard to measure. I'm with Sean overall on the challenge for a party that's in the White House in a midterm year, which is a much more challenging environment, regardless of what the laws are, what the issues are. You know, fundamentally, you just have usually an enthusiasm gap. So that, I think, is a bigger challenge for the midterm. I think that my worry is that, let's say it's Georgia, it's election night or a couple days afterwards, it's really close, 3,000 or 4,000 votes, 10,000 votes, whatever the number is. And what we have a fight over or between are actual election officials in those states, maybe the different counties. Maybe the Secretary of State will still be Brad Raffensperger, even if he doesn't win his primary. Where does he weigh in on this? Do we have you know, actual breakdown at the certification level? To me, is a more worrisome challenge. And then, of course, looking at that into 2024.
Setting aside who's in power, it used to be conventional wisdom that Republicans had an advantage in midterm elections just because of the way turnout is different in midterms and is lower, that Republican voters tend to have higher incomes. They have certain other demographic characteristics that have made them be more likely to vote in lower turnout elections. Amy, is that still true? Or the way that we've had this big shift in who's in what party coalition, is a midterm a better environment for Democrats than a general election? Is it equal, or do they still have a disadvantage simply because this is not a presidential election?
Right. So this is going to be a great thing to test And Virginia is going to give us an opportunity to do that in a couple of weeks because, you know, if you look just over the course of the last 10 years or so, the wealthy suburbs in and around Washington and Richmond have only gotten more Democratic. And yes, you know, age, income, education level, race, definitely more predictive of midterm turnout. The flip side of that, of course, is, well, what about in states like Georgia, where you need really robust African-American turnout, where you, or states where Democrats need to have younger voters come and turn out. And I've been also sitting in on groups of, you know, these younger Black voters who many of them did not vote in 2016 or voted third party in 2016, but voted for Biden this time around. Their frustration goes to the question of, you know, look, we had Trump for 4 years. We didn't like that. We had this incredible event in the summer of 2020 after the killing of George Floyd, where it seems that the country united around a sense that we need to make structural changes to the way we do policing. And here we are, it feels like nothing has changed at all. And so their frustration feels different than, say, the frustration that we were talking about at the beginning of the show about, you know, COVID's still here, or my life isn't normal. My life is still normal. And that's the problem. Nothing has changed. And I'm kind of getting tired of this.
Amy Walter is publisher and editor-in-chief of the Cook Political Report. Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
This was a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
I've been talking with Sean Trendy of Real Clear Politics and AEI and Liz Brunig of The Atlantic. We will be back to talk about vaccine mandates and religious objections to them. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow, columnist for Insider. On the right is Sean Trendy, senior elections analyst at Real Clear Politics and fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. One source of reservation about the COVID-19 vaccines for some Americans is the use of abortion-derived fetal cell lines to test the vaccines during their development. Now, the Catholic Church says receiving a COVID vaccine is morally permissible despite this remote link to abortion. However, the Church says Catholics should, if possible, get the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine instead of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which was not just tested, but also developed and produced with such cell lines. Nonetheless, the Catholic Archbishop for the U.S. military, Timothy Broglio, issued a statement this week noting that faithful Catholics may have objections of conscience to receiving a vaccine whose development had any link to abortion, even one conducted long ago, and that church teaching values the sanctity of conscience. That is, even though the church says getting vaccinated is morally permissible, a Catholic might nonetheless have a sincere moral objection, and that objection should be honored in law and policy, says the Archbishop. Around the country, a question for lawmakers and the courts is whether vaccine requirements must allow for religious exemptions and who should be eligible to take them, especially as governments are concerned about getting the vaccination rate as high as possible in order to reduce the spread of COVID-19 in the population. So Liz, you wrote about this week, about Catholics and the vaccine, and I find this to be sort of an odd distinction. How can it be simultaneously true that getting vaccinated is morally permissible in the eyes of the church and that a person might have a sound or sincere moral objection to the vaccine rooted in their Catholicism?
The Catholic Church is a pre-modern institution that persists even in our postmodern age. And so the way that the Catholic Church thinks about things is significantly different than the way that we, in our daily moral reasoning, just walking around being products of our age, think about things. And so for the Catholic Church, oftentimes, in fact, in almost every instance, when you actually drill down, moral issues are not yes or no issues. It's not a matter of, yep, that's okay in every circumstance, everywhere, completely unprohibited, go hog wild, or nope, never under any circumstance or any case, always and everywhere forbidden. And so you do get odd rulings like the one we have on the vaccines, where again and again, the church has said it is morally permissible to receive the COVID-19 vaccine, though the church would much prefer there were alternatives, but there aren't. And so it is permissible. And as Pope Francis has said, perhaps even an act of love and service to receive the vaccine. And at the same time, the church leaves room for an individual with a kind of conscientious objection, depending on their circumstance, to refuse. At the same time, because Catholics also have room for local authority, based on how the church is split up across the globe, some local ordinaries are not willing to back up claims of religious exemption. So in some locales, your archbishop will not say, yes, this is a genuine bona fide religious necessity that this person is expressing. And in some locales, they will. So that's where we are right now with the Catholic Church and vaccines.
One thing in the Archbishop's statement is he notes that those who refuse the COVID-19 vaccine on these religious grounds of conscience, that they have certain obligations to act to protect their neighbors from COVID-19, and they should be taking certain steps that people who are vaccinated may not have an obligation to take to avoid getting and transmitting the virus. At what point would getting the vaccine itself become not just a morally permissible act, but a morally required act for a Catholic? If this disease were significantly more deadly than it is, would the church be saying that you have to get the vaccine? I mean, I assume at some point, because Catholics are supposed to act to protect life, to protect their own life and to protect others' lives, is this just a cost-benefit question? If the risk to life were higher, would that then become a moral obligation?
Yeah, the Catholic Church is not strictly utilitarian, but that would definitely be a point in favor of an obligation. If it were a much more lethal virus, if it were a much, much more contagious virus, if it were killing babies and children, and this is something that, you know, isn't coming out of my head. This was something that was written, I believe, in the 2005 letter from the Pontifical Academy on the Sciences. They wrote, you know, especially where it comes to protecting the lives of children and babies, you know, these people who haven't had really a chance to live at all yet, then, you know, the obligation to get vaccinated and stop the spread becomes even higher. If it's an untreatable illness, if it's something like, imagine like a super contagious communicable form of rabies or something that people were giving each other, where once you're symptomatic, you're pretty much dead. That would be, I think, a tick in favor of an obligation. But again, it's just sort of the whole sum of the circumstance as opposed to a kind of straightforward cost-benefit analysis. I think it would be very difficult to stack up like, all the diseases ranked and figure out where we tick over from non-obligatory vaccine diseases to obligatory vaccine diseases.
Sean, you also have written about COVID-19 vaccines and religious objections. And one thing in our legal framework in the United States, in the Constitution and in a federal law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, if a person has a sincere religious objection to a generally applicable law or requirement on them, they sometimes have a right to be exempted from that requirement, but not always. And so can you walk through how that applies to vaccines here? When people say, I have a religious objection to receiving this vaccine, there's a government interest in increasing vaccination rates. When does which of those have to yield?
Yeah, so it doesn't get discussed as much as the case of Jacobson versus Massachusetts, which blessed a vaccine mandate with a $150 fine in today's dollars. But there is a line of cases out of the Supreme Court that says, you know, you have a right to bodily integrity. And along with that comes a right to refuse unwanted medical treatment. Which vaccine would certainly qualify as that if for some reason you didn't want that. And I feel the need to make the caveat up front that when they made the vaccine available to 48-year-olds, I was on the Ohio website refreshing reflexively to get it as soon as I can. But at the same time, those rights are not absolute.
So the Supreme Court has blessed, you know, forcibly giving medicine to violent inmates, forcibly, you know, putting strong prophylactic measures around things like living wills and whatnot. So it's a balancing test. And so when you get to something like a vaccine mandate, you have to balance the rights of society against the rights of the individual. Now, we're jealous of individual rights in this country, and it's, to me, one of the things that makes our country unique and great. We respect religious exemptions to the point where if we're in a war and you have a religious objection to fighting, you can avoid the draft and someone goes and serves in your place. Again, I think that's amazing. So to the extent we can accommodate these things, I think the law generally demands we should. And so we find ourselves back in the types of issues that Liz was discussing. If you had something that was more like rabies, that would, you know, strike you dead, or that was far more, contagious. Not that COVID isn't contagious, but, I think you could make a case for not accommodating the religious beliefs. In this case, though, I think it's a much tougher call.
But so then that depends on the number of deaths, right? I mean, we're going to come out of this year with some number of deaths that significantly exceeds what we would have achieved if we had achieved the vaccination rates, for example, that the United Kingdom has achieved. We might be talking about tens of thousands, over 100,000 Americans who die for that reason. So isn't that's something that makes the government's interest in the mandate compelling, right? And that's just a matter of numbers. At some point, that number is high enough that it should overcome more of these objections?
It absolutely is a numbers game. And, you know, one of the strongest counters, I think, is that if you go and get your vaccine, your chances of dying are very, very low. The deaths that we are seeing, first off, most of the deaths we're seeing in the grand total come from a time where we didn't have a vaccine. And there were other types of refusals that were driving that. But the deaths among that we're seeing this year are tragedies, but they're largely among the people who make the choice not to receive that vaccine. What I would say is that the vaccine were less effective if it only decreased the risk of death by 40%. I think you then have a stronger case.
What do we do if we create a regime that allows for religious exemptions? And I would note that existing mandates for childhood vaccines, it varies from state to state whether you can claim a religious exemption to those or not. A lot of people will lie. And we've seen this, in all sorts of aspects of the COVID response, that when you structure the rules such that people have flexibility around them to do what they want, a great many people will do so. And there will be people with sincere religious objections, not getting vaccinated for that reason. And then there will be people who have other reasons why they don't want to get the vaccine who will assert that they have a sincere religious objection. Is there anything to be done about that? And does that enter into the question of whether to allow the exemption? I mean, I think a reason that some states have not allowed this for childhood vaccines is that the exemption process simply gets abused.
The Supreme Court, not that we would necessarily want the Supreme Court adjudicating all of these cases, has actually dealt with that very issue in the past. In the case of conscientious objection, also, I believe, in the case of individuals like Jehovah's Witnesses who didn't want to take any kinds of vows to the state, including the pledge and so on and so forth. And the point is that in the past, the courts were perfectly willing to investigate whether someone was or was not a bona fide member of whatever they were representing themselves as, And, that seems sort of scandalous to us now. I kind of like it. I would love to be appointed as the Supreme Court's Catholic inquisitor. I'll figure out if somebody's Catholic or not. I'll report it back. But
isn't the trouble here, it's not enough to figure out whether they're Catholic? I mean, the sort of mealy-mouthed guidance from the church here, a Catholic could have a sincere objection, but most of them wouldn't.
It's not like, right. It's not exactly mealy-mouthed. It's just incredibly complicated. It's hard to know whether someone has a bona fide issue with their conscience or not. That's something they have to represent to you. In the Catholic Church, I think the way to, think about that is, Catholic clergy need to be communicating to parishioners, if you misrepresent yourself as having an incredible, burden of conscience that prevents you from receiving the vaccine, but in reality, you know that it's mainly a political thing, or you just can't be bothered, or something like that, then that's a sin, right? I mean, and a fairly serious one. And that far exceeds the evil of receiving the vaccine, whatever it may be. So there should be fairly serious warnings going on there. That's always a risk you run with any kind of exemption offered for religious reasons, that you're going to get ideological reasons folded in there. I have a pretty long spiel on this. I think it's because liberalism doesn't actually have any way to distinguish between religions and ideologies the way that it conceives of religion. But, you put aside that sort of perennial problem. I think that what we need to do is expect our religious communities, right? Our clergy in all of our religious communities to really take seriously their duty to keep our people safe, their people and all of our people safe and healthy.
Sean, what do you make of that? I mean, one of my concerns is that, you know, the sort of person who might misrepresent the nature of their Catholicism to a government agency is probably someone who's not that concerned about a priest telling them that they're sinning. So is this sort of compliance issue something that concerns you?
I mean, obviously it does. You know, my first and second responses were already put out wonderfully by Liz, and I don't know how much I can expand upon them. Just the, you know, we do have ways for, you know, courts and governments to ferret these things out. It's not easy to be, you don't just say, I'm a conscientious objector, I don't believe, and it's done. You know, you have to appear and explain. And I think there is some degree of self-policing that we can expect from religious groups. But my third point, which I think is something we sometimes lose track of, and I think we're increasingly losing track of it in some of our civil liberties debates and discussions, is that at a certain point, our entire system is predicated on the idea that, you know, these types of utilitarian sacrifices are worth it to guard liberty. Like, yes, if you have these exemptions, we'll probably have more people die from COVID than we would otherwise have. That there are costs to being a civil libertarian and having a strong framework of civil liberties. But I think in the big picture, those are worth it.
We have reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Bruna gets your soapbox.
I love Halloween, mainly because it's a precursor to my favorite part of the year, which is Christmas. It begins my Christmas pregame. But there's one thing I don't like about Halloween, and that's the adult sex part of Halloween. And that's like adults dressing up in sexy versions of kids' costumes. For some reason, we have these two holidays 100% concurrently, and they're kind of mixed together. The whole thing is just weird and unappetizing. I would suggest we sort of separate them somehow. I wish they were just on different days or something like that. But to the degree that we have to have them together, I would just suggest that we do them in like totally different locations. So if you're a college student or an adult who is older than that and you still behave like a college student for some reason, for God's sake, don't trick or treat or whatever. Like, stay at a party, stay indoors. Don't go out on the street doing your sex costume thing around all the kids and me when I'm trying to vibe in a cozy way on Halloween. Thanks.
Sean Trendy, what's on your mind?
So I was thinking back today on the movies of my youth, and what struck me is how funny many of them were. We had movies like Airplane, The Naked Gun, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, that were just dedicated solely to making us laugh, often at the expense of plot and cinematic value. When I look at IMDb at the movies that came out in 2019, the ones that are listed in comedies are kids' films like Jumanji and The Addams Family, or crossover genre movies like Zombieland Double Tap, which is apparently a horror comedy, which I'm sorry, is not really a comedy. I get it. Hollywood's a global business and American comedic tastes don't necessarily export well. But is one too much to ask? Because if there was ever a time America needed a good belly laugh, it's today.
For my rant, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, a Democrat, says central banks around the world have gotten too woke, and that's putting us at too much risk of inflation. Now, if you think Jay Powell is woke, that's probably because of how he and the Fed under his leadership talk about the importance of monitoring unemployment not just in the whole population, but in groups who have historically had elevated unemployment, like Black Americans. This is not a deviation from the Fed's mission. It is the Fed's mission. The Fed is supposed to aim for maximum employment and stable prices. Now, are we really at maximum employment when Black unemployment continues to be double white unemployment? That's not political correctness. It's a way of evaluating whether our monetary policy works for everyone. And if it's woke, then the Fed is right to be woke. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Sean Trendy, Elizabeth Brunig, and Amy Walter. This week's show was produced by Michelle Aloy and Sarah Fay. Our production fellow is Nisha Venkat. The show was recorded and mixed by John Meek, and Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more of Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.